This meeting is now being recorded. Joining the meeting.
Yvette Pena.
I've been there 12 years and it's
amazing. Hi, this is Douglas. I'm here with Justice Rivera, Christina Yope, and Carmen Castro-Rojas. Also, Diane Balach has stepped out. Can people identify who they are on the phone?
Yvette Pena?
Janet Hudick?
Oh, Janet Hudick.
Tracy,
are you
here?
Hi, Yvette.
Joining
Hi.
The meeting.
Manuel.
Christy Kessman's here.
Alan Hertzfeld.
Who is that?
Joining the meeting.
Judge Austin.
Joining the meeting.
He's the ledge representative at OGA for court interpreter matters.
Joining the meeting.
Elizabeth Tom Helmuth from CLASP.
Joining the meeting.
Jace Chong.
Joining the meeting.
Bao Lu.
Jace Chong.
Hello, this is Bao. Hi.
Hi, Bao.
Hi.
Hi, Bao.
Hello.
Joining the meeting.
Angeline O'Donnell.
Did you get my name? This is Jace Chong.
Okay.
Joining the meeting.
Dennis Hayashi.
Joining the meeting.
Mary Lou Erin Duran.
Joining the meeting.
Shui Nguyen.
Joining the meeting.
Rebecca Riley. Hello.
Hi, Becky.
Hi.
I think everybody's just checking in, then we'll be taking roll call momentarily.
Okay.
Is Ken Babcock on the line?
Okay, we know Chris Volkers and Steve Austin are going to be late. Who else are we missing?
Actually, Steve Austin's on.
Oh, hi,
yeah,
Steve.
I thought I heard him.
I thought you said you weren't going to come on until 12:30.
I sneaked out of my other meeting even faster than I thought I could.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Deborah Donson. Alexandra Johnson. Ginger Lamar. I think Ginger may be late. Justice Marquez, I know, has a conflict. Lisa McNaughton. Mike Roddy. Jose Varela. Chris Volkers.
She might be late.
Justice Zelon.
Joining the meeting.
Lisa McNaughton.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. Hi, how are you? Sorry to be late.
No problem.
We've got most people, but we're still missing about five, so I think we'll give it a couple more minutes.
Okay.
Joining the meeting.
Deborah Johnson.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Doug. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good.
Joining the meeting.
Jace Chan. Hi, good afternoon. This is Jace Chan. Did I miss a roll call?
No, we're
joining the meeting.
We're keeping track as people join.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
Joining the meeting.
Jose Varela.
Hi, Jose.
Hey.
I'm so sorry for being late.
No problem. We're still waiting for just a couple more people now. Is Justice Marquez not going to be on the call at all?
No. He has a memorial service.
Oh.
And I have to apologize, just Jose. I also am going to have to leave the call at about 1 o'clock because I've got some things going on in my county that I have to sort of attend to. I'm sorry.
That's great, Jose. I think what we all are hoping for is that the meeting will be over by then. That's my hope.
Well, there's a lot of great work there. I sort of agree with you.
Thanks.
Would you like me to clarify the call-in number, Mr. Rivera?
I'm sorry?
Shall I go ahead and clarify?
Kat Price to clarify the call-in numbers for working group versus the public.
So the call-in number for today, which I think everybody has been on, is 1-877-820-7831. The passcode for public participants into the meeting to listen in as a member of the public for this call is 914-2677. There's a different passcode that members of the working group have themselves in the meeting invitation for their speaking roles in this meeting.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask that anyone who's on the call who may have called in as a participant, who may be a member of the public, to call back and join in as a member of the listen-only public. Again, that passcode for listen-only public members would be to call in the public dial-in number 1-877-820-7831. And again, the public passcode is 914.
Joining the meeting.
Ken Babcock.
Could you say that last number, the passcode again?
Sure. The passcode for public participants into this meeting is 914-2677.
Okay, thank you. Okay, it sounds like Ken just joined us, so it sounds like we have enough people to start. I think everyone who's planning to be here on time is here. Is that right?
Yeah, some people may call in later, but probably announced.
Okay. So, good afternoon. Welcome to the members of the Joint Working Group, as well as members of the public who are listening to our meeting. I would like to, right from the top, remind everyone that this meeting is being recorded for posterity. And I'm going to skip the roll call for now because I want to do something with that later. We have set aside 2 hours for the meeting starting at 12:15. It is now 12:25, so an hour and 50 minutes. We are hopeful that if we get our work done, we can all leave the meeting earlier than 2:15, but if it is necessary, we can use up to this line for our meeting for up to 2:15 in the afternoon. I want to remind everyone that because we're on a conference call, it's important to say who you are before you speak so that when we record, our recording makes sense to people and we all know who is speaking on any given subject. I'm going to begin by doing a bit of housekeeping, which is approving the minutes of the closed session. I know many of you did that by way of email.
Actually, the open session.
I'm sorry, the open session. The open session.
Joining the meeting,
Valeria Sasse.
She's a staff person.
Okay. Many of you did that by email, but I think we need to finalize that in this meeting. And so what I'm going to do is have Doug call the roll and ask each of you to vote yay or nay on approving the open meeting with closed session minutes of October 21 and 22.
And these are the separate minutes that were prepared for the open session, not the closed minutes that all members previously approved. So Justice Rivera?
Aye.
Judge Covarrubias?
Aye.
Judge Austin?
Aye.
Ken Babcock?
Aye.
J.S. Chan?
Yes.
Tracy Clark?
Yes.
Deborah Donson?
Yes.
Judge Hayashi?
Aye.
Janet Hudak?
Yes.
Christy Kussman?
Approved.
Bao Liu?
Yes.
Lisa McNaughton?
Aye.
Tui Nguyen?
Yes.
Yvette Pena?
Yes.
Judge Riley?
I'll abstain. I wasn't there.
Okay. Jose Varela?
Gee. Yes.
Thank you. Is there anyone else on the call that I missed?
No. Okay. Thank you. That is done. Now, the meetings, there will be minutes prepared for this meeting as well, and they will be distributed and posted to the Joint Working Group webpage, but I don't think those are going to require approval, or will they?
They will require approval.
Okay, so we'll do that by email?
Correct.
Okay. All right. We put out the public notice for today's meeting, and as of the cutoff time of 9 a.m. yesterday, we did not receive any written comments, so that none were forwarded to you. We did receive a letter after the cutoff time, and we're going to figure out exactly how we're going to process that and prepare, you know, whatever, add it to the comments, prepare a response, do whatever it is we need to do in order to get that part of the record, but it came in too late for us to be able to deal with that today. So that will be disseminated in some other fashion. So I'm going to hand this off to Judge Covarrubias just to get us started.
One thing I'll also ask everyone, if you are on a speakerphone, to make sure we keep down the noise, is that we may put yourself on mute and then unmute when you want to join in. But I want to thank everyone making the time to come and join in this meeting. Our main agenda, again, and objective, is to review and approve the revised language access plan, which is, again, following our very, very productive meeting that we had in October. Justice Rivera and I would like to really thank everyone for all their hard work that's continued on this project, not only staff, but also Christina, who's put in a great deal of time and effort. It just amazes us when something comes up and the response and how quickly they get to these, and getting emails at 7 o'clock in the evening sometimes just to show how hard they're working on it. And so it's really gratifying to see how much effort has been put into it by everyone to get this plan into place. Following the formal public comment, and we are very close to, again, being able to present a final plan to the Judicial Council. We're still hopeful that we'll set this up for approval from the council in January of this coming year. Doug, do we have any indication as to when that would be?
The council meeting?
Joining the meeting.
I think it's January 22nd.
In fact,
that's the target date we have at this point?
Yeah, we have to submit the final plan to Executive and Planning Committee by the week of December 15th. And then the council will consider it for approval at their January meeting, which I believe is around January 22nd in Sacramento.
Correct, Sacramento. Mm-hmm.
Now, you should have all received, that was sent out, the revised plan. The yellow highlighting in the revised plan is where there is new revised text. And if you think that corrections are needed before approval of the group, we ask that you be please prepared to state the specific page or recommendation number and give and provide the precise word changes that you're proposing as any modification. Because of a very compressed timeline that we have for processing this after approval, there may not be much time to send anything back to staff for redrafting. So we are striving to complete all the changes during today's meeting. Also, to get my word comments on the margins, there are some plans and areas that we've asked the joint working group members to look at the new language very, very carefully. So with that, I think that sets the framework for us to begin. And I'll pass it over to back to Justin Rivera.
Okay, thanks, Manuel. All right, so generally speaking, the major changes that have occurred in this plan are that we moved language around, particularly we put the language about the implementation process earlier in the plan and revised some of the language about the challenges to the court and move those so that they were, that the negatives were, you know, farther into the plan and the more positives were closer to the front of the plan. We also revised some of the phasing after the October meeting, and then Christina did some clarifying work at pages 26 to 28 about the definitions that are going to be applied. So that's just a general overview.
Good job.
So,
you know what I'm on?
I'm sorry, who's speaking? Who's speaking?
She turned it off. She put herself on mute.
Oh, okay. So here's how I would like to proceed, and if anyone has an alternative view, please let me know. But I'm going to proceed from the assumption that everyone has done their homework and that we sent the plan out, everyone read it, that you've got whatever comments that you have on it, either changes you would like made or issues you want to raise, that you're all prepared to do that. And so rather than going through the plan page by page and recommendation, which is what we did in October, I'm going to begin by simply asking you, putting aside the meeting handout that you received yesterday, just looking at the plan, the November 25th, 2014 draft of the plan in its entirety, I'm going to ask each member in turn whether they have any proposed changes to the text of the plan. And I'm going to again ask Doug to call the roll to give each person an opportunity to propose changes to the text. So starting with me, I have none. I already did mine.
Judge Covarrubias?
There's just one. That's on page 43. Recommendation number 11. I will just read how what I am proposing, and it goes as follows: an LEP individual should not be ordered to participate in a court-ordered program if that program does not provide appropriate language accessible services. If a judicial officer does not order participation in services due to the lack of a program with language capacity, the court should order the litigant to participate in an appropriate alternative program that provides language access services for said court user.
I'm sorry, that provides language access services to what?
For said court user.
I'm missing the two.
For a court user.
For the, okay.
In making its findings and orders, the court should inquire if said programs provide language access services for LEP users to ensure their ability to meet the requirements of the court.
Okay, so as I understand it, Mrs. Maria, as I understand it, Manuel, you are changing, the primary changes are that you're just explaining, instead of using the term accessible, you're saying provide language access. And you're changing must to should in the last sentence in both places.
Correct.
That's pretty much
my concern primarily is some of these, I'm not sure how we, until we get these resolved or get some training, some of these programs as a court, judicial officer, they're actually mandated to order it. It's required under legislation. And so I just have some concerns about telling the judicial officer that they must not order it when they're so, when legislation is saying they have to order it. And also making the inquiry to find out not only are they providing it, whether they can or cannot, it's up to them to start providing those services. But that was just some of the concerns I had about that paragraph.
Okay.
Also, there's a sentence in there in the middle, near the end, must work with, it was kind of not clear to me what that was referring to.
Where is that? Oh,
it's
the bottom, work with.
The second to last sentence.
Yeah. And you've changed that, should inquire
if said program provides language access services for LEP users.
Okay. Is Justice Elon on the phone? Okay. Because she worked on this, and I'd be very interested in her take on it. But she's not on. Okay. You've heard the changes and the explanation from Manuel about Recommendation 11. Does anyone have any further suggestions relating to the language? Okay. Let's, as a working process, include this language for now. And if Justice Zelon appears, we will circle back and have her take a look at it. Otherwise, I'm going to assume it's okay with everyone else. All right, next on the list.
Judge Austin. There.
Judge Austin.
I pushed the mute button when I shouldn't have. I don't have any additions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ken Babcock.
I don't have any additions.
Thank you, Ken.
Jayas Chan.
Yeah, I don't have any addition too.
Tracy Clark.
No addition.
Deborah Donson. Deborah, are you there?
Sorry, Doug, I was on mute. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I had two recommendations. Recommendation 34 on page 59. Can we? Is that a permissible topic?
Anything is a permissible topic as long as you actually give us language.
Okay. I was just proposing to change services outside of court proceedings to something else. Courts should consider the use of bilingual volunteers to provide language access services at specific points of contact in the courthouse considered appropriate.
Instead of outside of court proceedings, you are proposing at other points of contact in the courthouse?
At specific points of contact in the courthouse considered appropriate.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble.
At specific points of contact in the courthouse considered appropriate.
Okay. Only because outside of court proceedings, because interpreters do so much work right outside of the courtroom, that seems a little ambiguous.
Okay, any discussion of that suggestion?
This is Becky Riley. I guess I'm having some trouble hearing her, but I know she's talking about page 59, but I didn't understand what she's referring to on page 59. Could that be clarified?
Recommendation 34.
Oh,
page
sorry.
60. It's on page 60, Becky.
Oh, pardon me.
Okay,
so the new language is courts should consider the use of bilingual volunteers to provide language access services at specific points of contact. And then there's another word.
In the courthouse, considered appropriate.
In the courthouse, considered appropriate. I'm having trouble with the grammar.
So, Deborah, is your concern?
This is Christina.
This is Christina. I'm sorry. You said that your concern was that there's a lot of things that happen right outside of the courtroom, but outside here is not modifying the courtroom, but court proceedings. So. Does that answer your concern, or are you still wanting to reword it?
Well, I just thought that it was leaving open the door to the possibility of referring to specifically outside of the courtroom. But if you think grammatically that's covered, that's fine.
Yeah, I think it's clear that we're talking about, well, perhaps we can say something that's slightly different. To provide language access services outside of court proceeding.
What about in addition to court proceedings where appropriate? So that we don't get that idea of inside, outside, or courtroom? Okay. It goes the wrong
way. This is Rebecca Riley again, or Becky Riley. It occurs to me that most of the time, and maybe I'm wrong, and an interpreter will correct me if I am, but I think most of the time when something is happening outside of the courtroom is actually part of a court proceeding. They've just stepped outside of the courtroom to talk about something, but perhaps there's something else going on here.
Yeah, this is what I was.
This is Maria. I think that's exactly what Deborah is trying to clarify.
Yes.
You're right, Becky. I'm wondering if we should just put it in another place and say, other than in court proceedings, courts should consider the use of
at relevant points of contact other than court proceedings.
Yeah.
Or something like
that's
that.
That's good.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Does that work?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Deborah, does that work for you?
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay, does anyone else have any comment on that? Okay, Deborah, what's your next one?
Recommendation 64 on page 104.
Deborah, for some reason I'm having trouble hearing you. Can you get a little closer to your microphone?
Yeah, I'm right up against it.
How's that? Is that better?
Much better. Thank you.
Okay. I was looking at the last sentence in recommendation 64.
64
or 62?
64, page
104.
Okay.
What?
How page number is it? It's page
89. Yeah, okay. So, complaints regarding court interpreters?
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the last sentence where it says the process will be clearly communicated to all of those different parties.
Yeah.
And I just thought the way it was written, it sounds as though like the inner workings of the, you know, the systematics of how that's done is going to be, you know, relayed to all those people as opposed to just the fact that there's a process available. So I guess what I was proposing was a sentence that says, once the process is in place, general information concerning the process must be made available to all those parties.
Yeah, once the process is created, what was the next phrase?
General information concerning the process must be made available, or it's just information concerning the process must be made available. Because the way it's written, it's, okay.
Right. I understand what you're saying. You're saying the point isn't to reveal all the ins and outs and the procedural niceties of the process, but rather to inform everybody who's interested how to start the process.
Exactly.
So can
this
we say...
This is Becky Riley again. How about just saying the availability of the process will be clearly communicated?
Oh, that would be an easy fix.
Except that people need to know how. This is Christina. It's more than just that the process is available, but it's how one does it. We don't need to do the inner workings, but is there a complaint form?
Right.
What's the form? So,
how about information about initiation of the process?
Sure.
Joining the meeting.
Okay. Any discussion on that? All right. We're going to move on then. Deborah, do you have any more specific suggestions?
No, thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Deborah.
Judge Hayashi?
Well, on page 93, the recommendation number 75, you sent out already amended language on December 5th, which would take the place of what's in the November 25th draft.
Yes, that's right.
So, I mean, I think that particular amended language is what the proposal is to substitute in the November 25th draft.
This is Maria. Dennis, what you're saying is, I'm sorry, I'm not seeing, these aren't matching up for me. You're talking about recommendation 75?
Right, on page 93.
On page 93.
The waiver.
The waiver, okay.
Yeah, the waiver.
Okay, I was gonna have people look at that separately. I'm going to go to that after we do the roll call and get everything else in place.
All right.
Anything else?
No.
Okay.
Janet Hudak?
No.
Christy Cussman?
No, just something on 75 when we get back to that later.
Okay.
Balu?
No addition.
Lisa McNaughton?
Yes, a few things. In general, it's excellent, but a couple things. Typo on page 10, fourth line down. Implementation is missing an E.
Yay. Thank you. Nice. That's a nice catch, Lisa.
You read it.
Wow.
Thank you. Another typo, page 48, and recommendation 16, fourth line down, interpreting, has the E and the R inverted.
Interpreting.
At the very bottom of 16, second line from the bottom up.
Oh, I see.
Got it. Interpreting. Interpret.
Right. Now, on a more substantial note, page 52, in the first main paragraph, I would propose at the end of the third line the word must instead of should, must preclude the use of friends and family. And as interpreters rather than translators. The must issue actually is resolved in Appendix A, Recommendation 22, so it's not really a change. It's just putting it in sync with Recommendation 22 in Appendix A.
You know, I wonder if we can reach the same place if we simply eliminated the word should. So we said, it should be noted here that in addition to the absence of quality control, there are other factors that preclude the use of friends and family as translators.
Mm-hmm. That's fine, except interpreters rather than translators.
Yeah.
As, I'm sorry, as interpreters, yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry, was there something else in that paragraph?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any comment on that from anyone else? From any comment on Lisa's suggestion? Okay. Go ahead, Lisa.
Page 53 in recommendation 22, I would like to remove the word opposing both times that it's listed because we're a non-certified, so it would read, absent exigent circumstances, when appointing a non-certified, non-registered interpreter, courts must not appoint persons with a conflict of interest such as parties or witnesses or family members of parties or attorneys. Having a family member on the same side of the person they're interpreting for doesn't help anything either.
Well, it doesn't help, but I'm not sure it creates a conflict of interest is the problem. I mean, we're limiting this to conflict of interest, and
oftentimes relatives will tend to embellish and add their own two cents worth.
I absolutely understand that, but it still doesn't create a conflict of interest, I don't think, under the general meaning of that term. Does anyone else have any comments?
Well, this is Becky Riley, and just thinking about the practicalities, at least in civil cases, that sometimes if you completely preclude the use of family members or friends, you're going to wind up with somebody who has no interpreter of any sort. Until we have interpreters available, of course, but in a situation like this, I don't know. I'm a little uncomfortable with that mandatory language.
Throughout the plan, it is stipulated that the interpreter be qualified, certified or registered, or provisionally qualified. So
my understanding of this recommendation is it is that situation in which you've got 5 minutes to issue a temporary restraining order in a domestic violence case, and nobody can translate because it's some language that nobody understands,
mm-hmm.
except the friend that the person brought to court with them. And all they need to do is get the words on the paper correctly so that it can be given to the judge to issue a temporary restraining order. That is what I would perceive as a exigent circumstance. And so I would be fearful of disallowing friends or family in that circumstance from being used to translate.
I would argue that domestic violence restraining orders is one of the most primarily mandated areas in which we need certified or registered interpreters. So there should not be an absence to begin with. And those are stronger orders than some others, sign up for work release and within 10 days, for example.
This is Judge Covarrubias. I agree, but that's why we have also on it the absence exigent circumstances situation. But also, as I recall, one of the changes we made to that provision where it was an apparent conflict, and we removed that language to say this is a conflict when using opposing parties or opposing witnesses, because we had those situations arise before. But certainly, I agree that that's an area that would generally have a certified interpreter that's going to be a priority item. But I think we're really trying to find out, addressing that actual conflict, and not say it's an apparent, that's not apparent, that is a conflict of interest, and I think that's why we had modified that language previously in our discussions.
Correct. This is Christy Kessman, and this was, I think, part of what I raised, which is, when the judge tries to say something and there isn't somebody in the room who can speak that language, the judge leaves the bench and, do we just leave the person sitting in the room? We have to have some kind, for the bench officer and for the court, we have to have some kind of ability to tell them that it's continued to tomorrow or something. And the reason why this rule was specifically on the exigent circumstances was because we wanted to make sure that the judge wasn't going to appoint an opposing party, and that was it. This is Janet Dudek. That was my understanding of the previous time we've met and discussed this recommendation.
So are we leaving it the same?
Well, I'm going to have to get a sense of what the group wants. So if I could ask, this is Maria, I would like to ask people to weigh in on whether they want to leave it as it is or change it in some way, either as Lisa suggested or in some other way. So if each of you would just pipe up.
This is Jose Varela. I think that there's a legal, you know, sort of relevance to the word exigent. And I think that there may be an underlying concern that judges will go soft on the word exigent, because exigent means what it means. It's an emergency. It's a very unique situation. It's something that, but for, you know, a very specific thing, it wouldn't be done. It's just the exigent component of it. And so I think that just having this discussion will underline to you know, people trying to get a sense of what is meant in that section. They will know that the discussion was that the word exigent has an actual meaning. Now, if you want to underline it, bold it, or do something to make it stand out so that whomever is reading this in the future understands that there is an emphasis on exigent, then that's, you know, a matter of the text itself. And so, but to me, I worry about adding any more sort of qualifiers, because I think the word exigent says it all.
This is Becky Riley. I think it should be left as
joining
it is.
Joining the meeting.
This
joining
is a
the meeting.
Technical.
Lamar.
Catherine, do people on the call know, is there already a definition of exigent defined in the code that would apply to this circumstance, even though now we're talking about conflicts of interest? I thought exigent was defined in one of the sets of circumstances already in one of the existing codes.
In a code? I don't know of any.
I don't know of any code. I think it's all in case law, and it's obviously judges by search and seizure law are aware of what exigent circumstances means. And it really does define within the Supreme Court law and even California state law, there's just a history of it having to be an emergency. You know, you couldn't get a warrant because, and there's like evidence was going to be destroyed, time was of the essence, somebody's rights were actually going to be hampered as a result of us not being able to do this. So the judges would know what exigent meant. And the other thing is that if some event that took place where a judge made the determination of exigent became relevant, the subsequent attorney would be able to argue that, in fact, the order was invalid because it wasn't exigent circumstances. And so there are sort of embedded safeguards when you use the word exigent.
This is Janet Hudick. The only thing that in civil cases, many of the LEPs are pro per.
Well, the thing is that the judicial officer still has an independent duty to ensure the application of the recommendation. It's not the LPA that's going to be necessarily the one giving the guidance. The court actually has to make, at least what I'm envisioning it, the court's going to have to say, look, I'm going to have this person do this because I believe it's an exigent circumstance. I believe that this person could have physical harm done to him if this restraining order isn't done, or this. And they will know how to state things on the record, that will support a finding of exigence. And so this is an issue of judicial training and not so much the LP, you know, the person, the LEP that's before the court. This really is a responsibility of the court officer to ensure that the primary focus, which is that a certified court interpreter be there, if that can't happen, only in exigent circumstances can he go on, or she can go on.
Right. But isn't a lot of the PROs in written form when the petition is made? I mean, if they're not oral petitions, most of them are written petitions, correct? Am I wrong?
But many courts also require the person to appear at the time, and there's no, it's an emergency situation. So there's, this, I'm sorry, this is Bonnie Huff. There's an ex parte appearance. It depends court to court, and it depends on the proceeding, but generally speaking, it's usually an emergency procedure.
Right. I understand that, and I'm kind of looking at the whole picture. The only thing that, if we're issuing, for example, a restraining order, and a family member interprets, let's say for the victim, and there's an interest on behalf of the family member that the restraining order be given, for whatever reason there might be, wouldn't that be a conflict?
You know, the conflict probably wouldn't be noted by the judicial officer because they wouldn't know that. When the person served with a restraining order comes back to the hearing that they're entitled to in order to challenge the order, they would be able to find, and then this is where it's really important that judicial officers make a record of who it was that it was interpreting, that the minutes include who it was that was interpreting, because then if subsequent hearings are held and a person makes as a statement, you know what, this order is invalid because the person litigating had a conflict of interest, then that's something that could be brought up by that person. But just knowing, you know, I think like many of you know TRO law, they do happen so quickly that issues of conflict of interest, issues of you know, sort of legal terms are thrown out the window simply because public safety takes over. I mean, is this person in danger and is it going to be killed? And I think that the notion of most TRO law is better safe than sorry if there is a sense that this is a valid request for a temporary restraining order.
Well, here's the issue that I see, and just this conversation brought back a memory of a restraining of somebody being arraigned. And I guess it goes both ways, either to issue a TRO or to make a peaceful contact or no contact. It can go either way, either issue or not issue or, you know, remove the restraining order. I had a situation where it was a domestic violence case, and I was interpreting for the defendant, and there was the victim was present, and she wanted the restraining order removed. And because of distance and because of security issues, I couldn't stand next to the victim and interpret for her, and we did not have anybody. Well, we did have somebody available, but nobody emailed the coordinator to get that person into the courtroom at the time of the proceeding. And the judge asked the victim, do you fear for your life? And she had her cousin interpret for her. And the interpretation that was given was, the judge is asking if you love him. And of course she answered yes. But I'm just concerned that whoever the family member is not going to interpret correctly. How do
but
we
I don't
guarantee
see that,
that
as an exigent circumstance? This is Maria, sorry. If there is a hearing on a TRO and the complaining witness and the respondent is there because it was set for a hearing, I don't see how any judge could consider that an exigent circumstance.
And this is Manuel. And we're going back over the entire plan itself, and this is a small portion of it. But I think within the plan itself, when we had a look at the context of the plan, where I think we made it pretty clear that before we appoint anybody to serve as an interpreter, they need to be qualified. And so they have to go through that qualification process, the whole training. It's a whole change of focus of not saying, okay, you know some Spanish, go ahead, you know some Punjabi, whatever, no, that's enough, just let them know. We're saying you can't do that anymore. Before you even consider importing that individual, whether it be a family member, you have to go to some certification process and make sure that, again, we're trying to focus on here, I thought, that we make sure we don't do that with someone who has a true conflict that's apparent there. But we're still going to go through all this process and make sure they don't do things like that, that they have some level that they will be able to provide that type of services for them. So I understand that those are issues that certainly have risen in the past, and that's why we're trying to address this in the plan. I think the plan is okay
the way it sits. I'm sorry. This is Lisa, and I stand by my suggestion because if we're talking about exigent circumstances, the judge is not going to be taking the time to be provisionally qualifying someone. The judge wants to get some information over. We could take an example, perhaps, of a clarification of a restraining order, which, first of all, a family member may not understand, may not know the terminology. If the judge says, I forgot to mention that this restraining order will be put into the CLET system, you can't expect a family member to know what the CLET system is and be able to interpret it intelligibly. Whether the family member is on one side or the other really doesn't matter as far as lack of qualification. That person could have an interest in the case regardless.
This is Jenny Hudick. I agree with Lisa. Maybe adding some language that would stir that up.
Well, okay, this is Maria. There's a couple of things here. I think the first point is that Manuel makes the point that elsewhere in the plan, it is made clear, and I think there's a new law that makes clear, that you must go through the provisional qualification process. It doesn't matter whether you're in exigent circumstances or not. You still must go through the provisional qualification process before you allow someone to interpret for anyone. This recommendation is very, very narrowly focused on people who could have conflicts of interest and who would be provisionally qualified to interpret in an exigent circumstance. And what this says is, you always, if you read the plan as a whole, you always must provisionally qualify whatever interpreter you use, but you may not, you cannot use as a provisionally qualified interpreter someone who has a conflict of interest unless you are in exigent circumstances. So it's a narrow exception to an exception. And so I would really hesitate. That's the meaning of this recommendation. And if we take out the whole thing about conflict of interest, then the recommendation doesn't add anything to the other recommendations.
This is Lisa again. How about if we end the sentence after conflict of interest and do not describe possible people who have conflicts of interest?
Okay, this is Maria. So we would delete the examples because you want to delete the examples because
simply leaving in the word by leaving the word opposing in, we are only excluding half of the people who should be excluded. So I say my first choice is remove the word opposing, and the second choice would be remove everything.
Okay, well, we're just using this as an example, such as. It's not the total universe. And we point out that attorneys have conflicts of interest even if they're not opposing.
Correct.
So that's the example doesn't limit it to opposing parties or witnesses. It includes anybody who has a conflict of interest, but we use these as the most classic example of people with conflict.
This is Ann Marks. We did move away from including some examples and other recommendations. So if without it, it still meets the needs of the recommendation, that might be consistent with other recommendations in the plan.
Okay, so.
This is Tracy. I just do have a comment. I think that listing a few examples is beneficial if we can do it in a way that is comfortable with everyone, specifically the idea of attorneys. I know a lot of people seem to forget that they are, by definition of their role, biased, but they are pulled in all the time. So I do think it's enlightening and supportive of our goal to have a few things listed, especially the most common things. I understand what Lisa's saying in that listening a few things to clarify, you don't want to inadvertently kind of take away from people's mindset other people who also might have a conflict.
This is Becky Riley. We might add the words including but not limited to and then list those.
Yeah, that sounds good.
This is Jose Varela. I have to leave, and I have no additions to the plan. Take care.
Okay, thank you, Jose. Well, let me ask a more general question. This is Maria. Is it the understanding of folks reading this that a conflict of interest includes a bias in favor of one side or the other?
This is Lisa. I say yes.
Okay. If that's the sense that we're using this, because that is not my interpretation of conflict of interest in this context, but if that is the group's interpretation of conflict, then what if we were to say, must not appoint a person with a conflict of interest or bias?
I think that would do it, Your Honor.
Or bias with respect to the matter or with respect to any of the parties or something of that nature. Lisa, does that get us somewhere?
Yes, that would be fine with me, yes. Thank you.
So what if we said court must not appoint persons with a conflict of interest or bias with respect to the matter? How about that?
That's fine with me.
This is Tracy. I like that. Thank you.
Anyone have any other comment on that proposal?
Boston, I like it.
Okay. I think we've got it. Lisa, anything more?
Yes. Page 58, the last two lines in recommendation 29. There is a problem with the MOU as far as sending interpreters to interpret in clerk's offices or self-help centers. It says, for example, the court's interpreter coordinator could be on call to identify which interpreters or staff are available to provide services in the clerk's office or self-help center. The MOU of the SEIU people, for example, the bilingual employees, they get extra pay to do that, and we are not to be infringing upon their work, and so it's against their MOU as well as ours.
This is Maria. I think we, in the October meeting, we had a long discussion about qualifying each of these recommendations as it might pertain to one MOU or another. And we made the decision to put that in some place as a general statement and not to include all the various possibilities of where things might go against an MOU. But what we did do, I don't think we made any requirements, you have to do this if it was going to violate an MOU, but where we're only using examples, I think that we chose as a group not to highlight where something might be in conflict with an MOU if it's not something that's being mandated under the plan.
Right. As Lisa, I'm not suggesting that the MOU be mentioned, but perhaps if the last sentence on page 58 could read, for example, the court's interpreter coordinator could be on call to identify which staff are available to provide services. Just remove the words interpreters or. To me, that would solve the problem.
But
this is Manuel. I think we had covered that all in a different – that's why we moved up all references to MOUs and had it replaced, as Justin Rivera indicated. So that, again,
that's
always
why
take
I'm
that into account and do it with any MOUs.
Right. I'm not saying
some will have, but other counties won't have that issue.
This is Lisa. Again, I say that I'm not suggesting that the MOU be mentioned. Simply remove the word interpreters. Staff. I mean, interpreters
why?
Also are staff, but
right.
That leaves it to the bilingual people in the clerk's offices.
Joining the meeting.
Hi, this is Deborah. I don't know how it is in every courthouse, but I know historically, generally speaking, this causes a lot of problems in the workplace with either interpreters who are willing to go and cover those kinds of needs and interpreters who aren't.
Joining the meeting.
I thought that generally speaking, we were moving in the direction of administration not wanting interpreters to be available to, you know, assist in those places.
Well, this is Maria. My concern is that we have been consistently using the term staff as being non-interpreter staff and interpreters as being interpreter staff. And my concern in removing the word interpreters from that sentence is that the MOU you're referring to may not apply in many other counties. And I think it was the sense of the group that we wanted to maximize the utilization of interpreters where we can anywhere in the courthouse. And so I would not want to remove the word interpreters in that sentence.
And it could be a contractor, an interpreter that was hired that's not actually staff, that was hired for the day.
But this is Judge Austin. What if you added after available and appropriate? Would that address it? Because in some places it may not be appropriate because of the MOU, but
mm-hmm.
you'd have both there. But
this is Lisa, that's a possibility.
I like that.
This is Deborah again. I'm wondering where it says the court's interpreter coordinator. Just because, to my knowledge, there's so many courthouses that don't actually have coordinators, could that be changed to something like, for example, designated court staff could be on call? Or is it because...
This is Tracy. Deborah, even if there's not someone with the title of coordinator, isn't there usually someone who is taking on that role? And this is kind of an informal way of designating the person, not necessarily pointing to a title. And would that make a difference?
Well, I don't know. In my opinion, just based on experience, I think what you just said is wildly variable from one courthouse to another.
I think this is Diane. I think we're just using it more as a generic term. Or
uh-huh.
someone assigned in the courthouse to take on these kinds of responsibilities. So I think it just makes for a good generic term. So I don't think we place the same emphasis that you're speaking about, Deborah, on it. It's just a generic term. A point of clarity here. It's someone designated in the courthouse or court setting provides those services.
And it's offered as an example. It says, for example, so we're not saying.
Yeah.
Joining the meeting.
We win. I guess just because on a practical level the term is loaded in the workplace, so I just thought leaving it more general as, you know, a designated person would maybe communicate the information to more people more accurately in that general sense that you're talking about as opposed to specifying with the word coordinator.
Okay, let me just scroll back. Lisa, if we say on call to identify which interpreters or staff are available and appropriate to provide services.
That would be fine with me.
Okay, that'll work. Now let's talk about, I think since, my view is that since the reference to the court's interpreter coordinator is only an example that all the large courts have interpreter coordinators, and they would be the person you would want to call. You don't want to be just calling random people who are in that courthouse, even
mm-hmm.
though the interpreter coordinator is housed in another courthouse. So unless you have strong objections, I'd like to just keep it the way it is.
Fine. Sounds good.
Okay. Any other comments on number 29? All right, Lisa?
One more. On page 59, recommendation 31, the second to last line said, incorporating different solutions, including cloud-based fee-for-service models. I don't agree that people needing counter help should pay a fee for a remote service.
But isn't the intention of the court is paying the fee? Yeah, I think
it
the
doesn't
idea.
Specify.
Okay.
I'm not sure what it's referring to, but I'm assuming it's...
Christina, could you...
I'm sorry. This is Christina. I didn't write that in, so I'm not exactly sure what it's referring to. I'm assuming it's some sort of language line type
exactly.
thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and courts usually have contracts, right?
Yeah. Don't they? Courts pay for language line, don't they?
Yeah. Yes, they do. And this was, my recollection, this is Tracy, was that it was just a phrase to broaden access as technology grows, so we're not bound to a landline, language line type format, but could access it through web type formats as well, the same basic service.
Can we just footnote it and say this fee is paid for by the court?
We can actually just say including court paid cloud based fee for service models.
That would
be so that sounds fine.
Great. If it just because of the fee for service, it may have created confusion. So
okay.
Right.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, this is Lisa. That's all I had.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Greatly appreciate it. You really combed through this. That's great.
Thank you.
Who's next?
Twi, do you have specific changes?
Just one change. To be consistent, everywhere where it says college, to say community college. And that's it. No changes. Great job.
Do you know where those might be, Twi? Do you have them flagged on yours?
We can do a word search.
Okay. Did you mean with colleges, did you mean all interpreter training programs or education providers? Or? Well, I don't think there are 40 or universities. Twi, can you give us an example of where you saw that and you'd
like
it changed?
Yeah, like 73.
Many community colleges. Okay, where do we refer to community colleges there?
Or is that I wrote it down? There are a couple places where it just says colleges. I can do
so
a word search and send it to you.
On page 72 at the on page 72, the bottom of the last complete paragraph. It says courts should include schools, colleges, and universities in court community events. And I did the word search up until there. All of the other ones did say community college. And I'm not sure if it was intentional or not, but there are private colleges that are colleges, not universities, while college would include community colleges. But community colleges would exclude those other colleges. So colleges is more broad.
Okay. It sounds like we should go back and take out the word community college, which, quite frankly, I don't want to do. If this is an issue of consistency, so I definitely agree there could be private colleges, too.
We would be all colleges. So community colleges, private colleges would be included.
So let me just check, because this is Christina. So that's the issue description, which
joining the meeting
concerns me a little bit less. Recommendation 45, for example, talks about including the California Community College and state university systems. I think because we're saying including,
mm-hmm.
we can leave it like that. But it looks like the only issue where this is an issue is in this issue description, which doesn't seem that problematic to me. But we can do a global search just to make sure that we're not leaving community colleges out or private colleges out in our wording.
Good. There you go.
Okay.
Okay, Twi, anything else?
Nope. Very good.
Thank you.
Yvette, do you have specific changes?
Just one word that I noticed was, excuse me, I'm so sorry, page 10, the first paragraph in the highlighted section, next to last sentence has two words next to each other.
Ah, good catch.
Okay. And then just a question, I guess, on page 53, recommendation number 21, the last sentence says courts should not develop these systems in a way that does not create risks for LEP court users. I assume that that's some reference to the allegation that there have been raids from ICE, but
yes.
That language concerns me. It just concerns me. Because I don't know how helpful that is to courts. That was such a limited circumstance, and as I understand it, it only occurred in Kern County. I don't know what purpose that really serves. I think it creates the opportunity for a lot of confusion.
What do you suggest?
Striking it
completely?
Yeah.
Yvette, this is Maria. The reason we put it in there is because we want people to think about how they set up the systems so that they can be careful about not creating unintended consequences in the guise of helping LEP court users.
And I certainly appreciate that sentiment. I just all that we're asking them to do is so hard, every single part of it, that this risk seems so remote that I just would hate to create a sense of panic or paralysis because they're overthinking it all.
This is Christina. If we said courts should develop these systems in a way that does not have a chilling effect on LEP users' access to court services and take out the word risk,
sure. I mean, that's an improvement.
Yeah, this is Manuel. I know we also heard about some other chilling effects that they have of people being singled out. They figure they're singled out and kind of set aside when they do that. And that was from the court users themselves. So, I mean, not so much the risk, even just kind of being isolated out and being removed out and put over. It says they're going to be classified in a different way.
Right.
And so I agree. If we remove the risk and not have a chilling effect, hopefully that would cover it.
But other than that, I don't have any other comments. I mean, really good, incredibly good work. This was a lot to try to yeah. chew and bite and all of that.
Thank you, Yvette. Does anyone else have a further comment on the suggestion that's been made, which is to delete the phrase create risk for LEP court users so that it now reads that courts should develop these systems in a way that does not have a chilling effect on their access to court services?
On LEP users' access to court services.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Great. I hear no comment. We shall move on.
This is Christy. Chilling is probably a current word that's used. I'm worried about the long term abuse of, 10 years from now when somebody tries to read this, whether they're going to understand what that word meant.
This is Becky Riley. Chilling effect is something that is sort of a term of art in legal cases. I don't think it's going away. It's been around for a long time. I think judges will always understand what that means. But I don't know about other people, maybe.
Yeah, it's used, this is Maria, it's used very commonly in both First Amendment jurisprudence and also in anti-SLAPP jurisprudence and lots of other contexts.
And I think we get some context in the issue description as well, in case.
Oh, that's right.
I can't think of it right now, but I'm pretty sure we discussed. And if not, we could.
Perfect. Thank you.
Here, yeah. Well, we need to actually look at page 50 then,
yeah.
Maria, because we do talk about creating unique risks. So I think we probably need to, in the issue description, change that as well. Okay, anything else? Who's up next?
Well, actually, I mean, again, back to be specific, on page 50 in the middle
and first full paragraph, there is more context where it says, tacitly allow law enforcement agencies such as immigration and customs enforcement to target LEP users. So I'm wondering if there it actually works because it kind of gives a very specific and limited circumstance and the issue description can stay the way it is.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
Judge Riley, did you have other specific comments?
No, the only comment I have is that I'm hanging my head looking at how much work was done at that meeting that I missed in October. You all did an amazing amount of work. Very impressed.
You are absolved, Becky.
And then Ginger, you joined. Ginger, you're on, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Did you have any specific suggestions?
I did not. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Thank you, Ginger. Is that everyone?
Yeah.
Is Justice did Justice Elon add on at some point?
No.
No.
Or Chris Volkers? No. Yeah, that's everyone.
Okay. So did we miss anyone? No. Okay. Great. Now let's go through the new stuff, which is fortunately very limited in scope. Let's begin with page, if you look at your meeting handout, then you can go to the pages that are referred to there. So, for example, it's on page 27. This is the new language, and it's in the issue description on page 27, and it's also in what we talked about, page 42 and 43, and Manuel has already suggested changes in 11 that we have all looked at and I think finally approved. I don't think anyone had objections to his changes. I did want to get Justice Elon's take on it, but
just in event again, if that can be circulated through Justice Elon, and if she has something else, that I'd be willing to go with it as it is.
Can
but
you
if, email that's
her?
Just if she has any problems, with it, that's
can
fine.
Can we email Justice Elon?
Yeah, please. I'm going to have Katz volunteered to email her to see if there's a way we can communicate it to her now.
Okay.
Anyway, so just bringing your attention to page 27, which all of you read already, and the changes that were made. This is the clarification about the court-ordered but non-court-operated programs and the court's responsibility in making sure that they're language accessible. And that if they're not language accessible, that some other alternative means be utilized. But you can't just say, pay a fine instead, because many of these court-ordered programs are essential behavioral modification kinds of things and required by law. So the what we've tried to really highlight here is it is going to be the court's responsibility to go through all of the program people that they utilize and they refer people to and have a sit-down with them and make sure that they there is at least some programs that have language accessibility. Justice Elon says she's an oral argument. Oh, she's an OA. Oh, goodness. Okay. We'll have to figure that one out later. So anyway, I just summarized for you what we changed. Does anyone have any comment on those discussions? Okay, hearing none, let's move on to page 36. The change there is, as proposed, is it makes it explicit that we're moving up the deadline for providing interpreters in all civil courtroom proceedings and including family court services mediation, and then all other mandated proceedings by 2020, because the group, that was how we sorted it out in the October 21-22 meeting. So that's what's been clarified there. If you look at the language on the handout, it says new on page 36.
Makes sense to me. This is Becky.
Okay. Does anyone have any comments on that? Okay. Great. On page 40. This is where we added in Family Court Services mediation to civil proceedings as prioritized in Evidence Code 756. Any comment? This is what we decided to do in October. Does that look fine to everyone? No objection?
This is Tracy.
Yeah.
That is fine. I want to just go back on to that goal statement, the court-ordered, court-operated events.
Yeah.
If my notes were right and they're really sketchy here, we were talking about court-ordered programs in this. Is that right?
No.
Okay, just events. Okay. Then my notes are wrong. Okay.
It's not that it's not on the same timeline. It's just not included in this recommendation. That's discussed in a different recommendation.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. Okay, page 88. The only addition there is that we are recommending adding to our recommendation that we think a wide variety of stakeholders should be included in the implementation committee, and that they should include the people listed here: judges, court administrators, court interpreters, legal services providers, and attorneys that commonly work with LEP users. And that's not an exhaustive list. We may want educators, and we may want technical IT people, and we may want others, but we wanted to make sure at least these, because these were the persons that were expressing the most interest in being involved in the implementation committee.
So, this is Becky. I would just suggest, just so it's clear, that we would say including but not limited to, rather than just including.
I have no problem with that. It's a term of art we are all familiar with. Any other comment?
Just, I take it when we say judges, we also mean justices?
Yes,
and we need commissioners.
Should we say judicial officers?
So why don't we say judicial officers? Anything else? Okay, last item. Page 93, recommendation 75. We have reworked the waiver language, and I'm going to ask Dennis to lead the discussion on this.
Yeah, so essentially the changes as reflected in the new language that you got in the December 5th handout does a couple things. One, by directing the implementation task force to develop the policy is to ensure that we have one policy that will be distributed statewide, so that the way it was formally written was it looked a little bit like it was up to courts on their own to develop a process. So the thrust of the new language is to ensure that there will be one process that's developed by the task force. And at the end of the redrafted language in the December 5th handout, there's added language which reflects an expectation that the waivers are to be granted rarely, given the fact that the whole point of this exercise is to ensure that limited English-speaking individuals do get the services they need. And additionally, a proposal that any policy developed by the task force would include a process by which waiver usage can be tracked. to ensure that, you know, it's not overused, or perhaps if it's used too often, like what is the basis for that? So those are, I think, the main changes. There may be some wording changes, but generally the essence of the former 75 is contained in the new language as well.
Any comment? Well, this is Maria. I think it's an improvement, because I always all along had concerns about this waiver provision, and I think all of these factors and the knowingness and that the judicial officer is not just going to accept a waiver. If the judicial officer accepts a waiver from the party, that doesn't mean the judicial officers can't use the interpreter and all the other safeguards that have been built into this. Now, I'm much happier with it. I think tracking is going to be a challenge, but tracking is always a challenge.
This is Manuel. I take it on the last sentence, or actually the beginning with the policy, it should be reversed. The policy said shall reflect.
Yeah, there's a typo there.
Yeah,
that's the only other thing that we had on it.
Right.
We got it. Thank you.
Okay. I think it makes it really clear, and I think it's really good.
Okay. Well, guess what? We're done. I'm so excited. Okay. We are officially done, and I think what I'm going to simply propose that, and with this one kind of thing that's hanging out there, which is the court-ordered, court-mandated programs, I think it's fine, because there were changes made, and I wanted to make sure Justice Zeland was very much involved in writing that up. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to propose that we accept as a group, the plan as it has been amended today, which is why we wanted to use very precise language, which we did, and which has all been recorded, as amended today for presentation to E&P and to the Judicial Council. And I will ask each person to vote, and Douglas, if you would do the roll call.
Justice Rivera?
Yes.
Judge Covarrubias?
Yes.
Judge Austin?
Yes.
Ken Babcock?
Yes.
Jayas Chan?
Yes.
Jayas?
Yes.
Thank you. Tracy Clark?
Yes.
Deborah Johnson?
Yes.
Judge Hayashi?
Yes.
Janet Hudak?
Yes.
Christy Kussman?
Yes.
Ginger Lamar?
Yes.
Bao Liu?
Yes.
Lisa McNaughton?
Yes.
Tui Nguyen?
Special thanks to our co-chairs and staff, yes.
Thank you. Yvette Pena?
Yes, and I echo that thanks.
Thank you. Judge Riley?
Yes.
Jose left. Did I miss anyone?
Okay, well, this
this feels really good.
Yay! Before I hand it back to close out for closing remarks from Judge Covarrubias, I want to thank the staff, and I also want to thank the public who spent many people in the public, particularly CFI members, particularly independent interpreter members, particularly legal aid organizations, and some of our educators who spent the time to give us a huge amount of input that deeply informed the process that we went through in preparing this plan. It simply would be nothing as good as this if we didn't have the public participation that we've had. So I want to thank the public for all the time they've spent and energy they've spent preparing both written and oral comments. Thank the working group. Thank you. And the staff, of course. Huge thank you for all the, they're the ones that put pen to paper and made it all happen and worked very hard. So
those are my thanks.
Manuel.
I would like just to echo Justice Rivera's comments, especially to the public who did join in and spend their time and took time from their private activities to come in and join in and provide an enormous amount of information that really allowed us to get where we are today. Certainly the working group has been a marvelous group to work. Everyone has been on it, just put a whole lot of energy into it. Staff has just been remarkable. You know, our task when we were formed was to prepare a very comprehensive language access plan for our 7 million limited English proficient court residents and users. And I think the work that we all have put in, the work that we have accomplished at this time shows that we really have met that goal and task of preparing a very and probably the most comprehensive language access plan that will serve our limited English residents here in California. And I think it's a long time coming, and it's some great work has been put to it. So I'd like to thank everyone, especially our consultants, that when we started off this project, we said, how are we ever going to get this? We need some help. And fortunately, our Chief Justice joined in and tried to provide the financial resources to be able to have Christina as our consultant that we were able to select. I really want to thank her and Douglas. In addition to all the other staff, Ann, Christina, everyone, for all the work they've done. And in such a relatively short period of time, I've been involved in other groups, and I'm not sure anyone has been able to accomplish what we've been able to accomplish in this short period of time. And I look forward to the Judicial Council approving our recommendation. So thank you to everyone.
All right. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.